internships, design and creation, getting into the field and getting your hands dirty. What does real-world learning look like today? Two people dedicated to answering that question discuss that next on the K-12 Engineering Education Podcast. I'm Pius Wong. My guests today are from Schools That Can, a national education nonprofit based in New York City that has a mission of helping students realize real-world success. Joining me are Casey Lamb, Chief Operating Officer at Schools That Can, and Roger Horton, Director of Maker Programs there.
My name is Roger Horton. Before coming to Schools That Can, I led teams that managed reactor plants on Navy ships. I've worked with master craftsmen to build apprenticeship programs in other countries and engaged with communities to identify their most pressing challenges. And more recently, I was a teacher of world history and an engineering elective at a New York City high school focused on interdisciplinary learning. And here at Schools That Can, my focus is on our elementary and middle schools and our STEM and Maker programs.
Great, thanks. And Casey?
Yes, my name is Casey Lamb, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Schools That Can. My background is a little less exciting than Roger's. I have not stepped aboard a Navy ship, but prior to joining Schools That Can, I was a special education teacher and administrator working at district and charter schools in Atlanta and in New York. And then I came to Schools That Can about 6.5 years ago as the founding ED of our New York office. Initially, we started out with a focus on cross-sector collaboration, so bringing together district, charter, independent, and faith-based schools who were serving low-income communities and providing a safe space for them to share best practices with one another. In more recent years, we have shifted away from the focus on cross-sector collaboration, although that's very much still a part of our DNA, and have really put our stake in the ground around this idea of real-world learning, which we see as a really critical means for supporting a cohesive education to employment pathway. So we have programs with where we work with students, teachers, and school leaders from our cross-sector network of schools to help them build out real-world learning programs and integrate real-world learning practices into their classrooms.
Thank you, Casey. And so you really hit on the main thing that I was really interested in talking to you both about. You talked about how your focus at Schools That Can really is on real world learning, and you're going to have an event coming up kind of to focus on it, right? The National Forum. Could you talk about what that is?
Yeah, sure. So this is actually, we're really excited because not only is it the 2020 Schools That Can Forum, which just sort of sounds exciting, even though it's just what year it is. It's also our 15th annual national forum. So even when we started out as a grassroots sort of volunteer-led organization, we were gathering the schools from across our national network to come together once a year to share their practices and to engage in really important conversations. And we host this every year in a different city. This year, the host city is New York City, and we'll be at Cornell Tech, their state-of-the-art center on Roosevelt Island, which is really a sort of beacon of engineering education. And they're both doing a lot of really amazing work at the higher ed level and also with K-12 schools across New York City to integrate computational thinking and computer science. And the forum has one full day of conference sessions on things like social entrepreneurship and computational making, on design thinking and how to apply it to help students solve sustainability challenges, on how to incorporate career readiness and career pathways into high schools, on interesting projects like senior capstones, and a bunch of other really exciting sessions led by practitioners from our network of schools. In addition to the workshops and the speakers, we'll have a keynote session from the founding principal of the inaugural PTEC school in Brooklyn. And we have a pop-up makerspace that Roger can share a bit more about. And then we do school visits, so people get to get out into the community and see schools and actually see these practices in action. And forgot to mention that the topic of the forum this year is connecting education to employment in a digital age. So all of these sessions are really thinking about this question of what does it mean to prepare students for success in the digital age? And what can we be doing at the K-12 level to really make sure that we are equipping students with the skills and helping them understand what pathways are available to them so that they can pursue pursue interests beyond school.
You said a lot, Casey, and I want to touch on several of those topics. I'll get back to the forum in a second, but you kind of mentioned a lot of different buzzwords, and not just buzzwords, but real popular topics in the engineering education space right now. And so I want you to both help clarify for me my understanding of real world learning. I know that's the focus of Schools That Can, and that education to employment pathways is the focus of your forum. I heard you also mention things like, well, I know that Roger helped set up apprenticeship programs in the past. You had mentioned design thinking, Casey. You mentioned social entrepreneurship. I feel like all these different phrases, teachers and educators have heard parts of this. Are these all under that umbrella, I guess, of real world learning?
Yeah, so I think real world learning has become a more common term, and a lot of organizations might define it in slightly different ways. So, you know, I've seen some definitions that emphasize outdoor education specifically, or just learning outside of classroom walls. At Schools That Can, we have a pretty broad definition of Schools That Can that is really just at its core, hands-on, authentic, and applicable to the world beyond school walls. A few years ago, we published a rubric that is available on our website, which defines real-world learning for schools. And there's six components of it. So it's really about building partnerships with the community, whether individual experts or companies locally, so that students can both students can apply their learning in real-world context, and teachers can build partnerships so that they understand what the world outside of a school looks like, since many teachers have gone to school their whole life and then worked in school after graduating school. So helping to really provide that authentic context for applying the learning that's happening in classrooms. Yeah. It's also about really having a hands-on interdisciplinary approach. And we're sort of agnostic to the particular approach that you want to use, whether it's project-based learning or inquiry-based learning and giving kids a big question to explore, or using a design thinking approach and presenting students with a challenge and giving them a framework to find a solution to that challenge. But it's really about breaking down the walls between the different disciplines and giving students the opportunity to apply that learning authentically. It also includes looking beyond academics to other skills that are going to help students be successful in the real world. So we talk about digital literacy and also, you know, collaboration, creativity, critical thinking. We also think about how can schools sort of ground themselves in that larger education to employment pathway. So thinking about where students are coming from and what is the next step on their journey. You know, if it's middle school, for instance, in Chicago, we run a high school exploration program to help students and their families navigate that big step to high school and think about how that's going to help set them up for success in their longer education to employment pathway. So it's all of those things sort of combined that fit into our operationalization of real world learning.
Wow. Yeah. So it sounds like a lot. If someone were listening, let's say they're an engineering teacher and they wanted like a specific example related to them, what would that entail? What's an example of good real world learning that they could maybe implement in their environment?
So one school that we think does real world learning really effectively is MC Squared STEM High School in Cleveland. I'm actually going to be out there visiting them in just a couple weeks. And they have a lot of different things that are unique about their model, some which are harder to replicate than others. For example, their 10th grade students, they take their classes on the GE Lighting campus. So the GE Lighting headquarters for all of GE North America is located in Cleveland, and they have one building where the students attend their 10th grade classes. And during the 10th grade year, every student is paired with a GE employee as a mentor. So they have the chance to sort of get exposure to what it's like to work at GE. They're sort of academic program is grounded in these capstone projects. So they have, I think, 9 or 10 weeks where they'll work on a big interdisciplinary project that they present at the end of that time. And so one of the big ones that the 10th graders do is they design a lighting fixture, and they're getting feedback through the process from their mentor, and then they get to present it to engineers in GE for feedback. And through this whole process, you know, they're conducting research, they're looking at the science of electricity and using engineering design processes, analyzing the sort of costs and the potential profit margins, and then this is culminating in a presentation to the community.
You're totally describing, I think, kind of the dream engineering classroom that a lot of high school teachers have talked to me about. And it's also emphasizing for real this education to employment pathway. I assume that maybe GE has some kind of interest in maybe getting interns or something from this program, or is it just, they're just part of this education program? Is this like a win-win for them?
I mean, it's definitely a win-win for them. I actually, interestingly, don't know if they have a formal partnership that leads to internships or jobs, because it's 10th graders. And so then as 11th graders, they actually go and they're taking classes on Cleveland State University's campus. But they do have internship programs. And obviously, I think one thing generally that we found that's really important to education to employment pathway is about building the social capital and those relationships. So by building those relationships, inevitably, they're going to be students who are better positioned for internships and jobs at GE than others who don't have those relationships.
Sure, yeah.
I would just jump in and say too that it's really not just GE. We've found that there are advanced manufacturing associations like all over the country that the statistics are out there that there are millions of jobs that employers don't have, are not finding the employees with technical skills candidates to fill those jobs. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of these companies that have joined together and with these associations to figure out how to fix that. Schools Again has connected with them. We've started that process in New York City, and we have career pathways programs going on in Newark and in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. Where high schools are like formally connecting through these programs with local manufacturers so that students in their high school are in dedicated high school classes where they're learning specific technical skills to prepare them for employment. So we definitely see that as a growing trend to meet this need.
And so does Schools That Can help train people or teach people how to form these partnerships?
Yes. Depending on the school's capacity, our relationship may look a little different. So, you know, there are a couple of schools where we have much more of a hands-on approach, and, you know, we're doing everything from helping them identify the curriculum they want to use to working closely with the teacher who's leading the class and making sure that they have the materials they need, to helping to more formally gather an industry council of local companies who can provide guidance and advice over the course of the program. And then definitely, as Roger was mentioning, there's a lot of relationship building to, you know, coordinate site visits or bring guest speakers to the school so that students can really see what the world of work looks like and make decisions about what post-secondary pathway they want to pursue.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me that you're really trying to bring relevant education into these students' lives. And I guess, Roger, as an engineer, you probably have an easier time knowing what might be more relevant. Like, you could connect your classroom to the local engineering companies or the local tech companies, for example, here in Austin. If you're a teacher, and this happens frequently in engineering, if you're a teacher teaching engineering, but you don't have that engineering background, how can you figure out what is really relevant to work? How do you figure out what companies to connect to, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's a couple answers to that. One thing that comes to mind is that, you know, there are associations out there of professional engineers. One that comes to mind is the Civil Engineering Association, which is something mm-hmm. that I studied. And their whole purpose is, you know, a little bit separate from these manufacturing associations, which is kind of like a, you know, collection of employers bringing them together, a little bit like a chamber of commerce. These professional civil engineering association, they want to educate students and teachers about their profession, and they want to get them excited about civil engineering or about aerospace engineering or mechanical engineering. So they are engaging with students at career fairs and with schools and things like that. So there's outreach coming from professional engineers, and teachers can connect with those opportunities. So that's just a matter of like watching and connecting with those opportunities and then making specific connections. And a lot of times those associations will put together curriculum and resources that can teachers can tap into.
And one thing I would add to that is, so we're not running this currently, but we recently proposed a project that I think really aligns with what you're describing here, which is sort of calling it like a teacher in the workplace program, where we would have teachers from local high schools who are interested in building their own awareness and understanding of the local careers and industries. And then we would set them up with local employers to spend, you know, whether it's a immersive 1 week or a couple days over the course of a year, to go visit the employer and really learn what the workers there are doing and think about how can they bring some of those lessons back to their classroom, to the projects that they're doing with their students, and to the lessons that they're developing in their own just awareness of what they're preparing their students for. And so, you know, that's a cohort program that we are helping to develop and launch. But it also, if you're in a city where there isn't a Schools That Can or there isn't a program like this that currently exists, then I think I heard about one of our schools, the principal has been describing how he wants to be more creative about his teachers' professional development. And instead of having them go necessarily to the next conference, even though, of course, we do want people to come to the Schools That Can forum, but there, you know, how do we define professional development and what's going to be most useful for you? So if a teacher could sort of put together a one-day proposal of what would it look like to go shadow an engineer at a local company, and that could be a really valuable professional development experience, even if it's not, you know, doesn't follow the typical schedule of a conference or a PD workshop. So I think those are interesting ways for teachers to get exposure to what's happening in the world of work.
I know I've been really emphasizing the part of real world learning that you started talking about, Casey, the integration with your community. And I know that that's really important. I want to talk more about what makes real world learning successful. So something that I was trying to read about and doing some research about this is one of the metrics that a lot of people use for whether a program's successful or not is how well does it help marginalized groups, students who might not be traditionally supported in their education. Mm-hmm. Do you think real world learning has any special role to play when helping minorities? Or in engineering specifically, we often talk about women who are underrepresented in engineering, computer science, or underrepresented racial minorities. Does real world learning have any effect on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really big focus for Schools That Can. You know, our mission is to close the opportunity and skills gap. All of the schools that we work with in our programs are Title I schools serving students from low-income areas. And we've had a really strong focus on the elementary and middle school space, because that if a student gets to high school and they haven't had a preparation, they've had zero exposure to engineering, it's very tough for them to make up that ground to even have an understanding of what it's even to even engage with it as a career choice. We're working on our focus is on creating a model of a K-12 pathway and supporting these programs that are exemplars of what that looks like. And we think it's so important that students have that foundation of problem-based learning, computational thinking, taking a maker approach. We use maker pedagogy extensively in our programming with elementary and middle schools. And what's powerful about maker pedagogy is that it's designed to work with any student. They don't have to have a lot of pre-existing knowledge and experience. A huge problem with existing programs is that students are self-selecting into those programs because they already love computers. They already love technology. They're already into engineering because maybe they have a parent or a someone in their family who's an engineer. And it tends to heavily be boys. For example, an after-school or a weekend robotics program or a Lego program. Whereas our programs are designed to work whether it's after school or in the school day. And there's no prerequisites. So girls, students with disabilities, students of any background can work in collaborative teams, communicate, create things together, learn how to tinker, apply this maker approach, and feel successful and support each other. So that's what we really love about using a maker pedagogy to underscore the various STEM programs we're doing. And the part of that that connects with broader trends in education is that schools all over the country have been implementing these next generation science standards. And it's a huge transition for schools to make. But what's exciting about that is that the science and engineering practices are completely baked in and designed into the next generation science standards. So before, many of the state standards didn't really barely pay any lip service to engineering. It was all about science. Engineering was really left behind. And now engineering is a key part, like the engineering approach, engineering problems on the engineering design process. And that's a key underpinning of our programs. And so we're now working with schools and elementary teachers to bring science and engineering practices into what they're doing in their classrooms.
Just to add one other thing to that, I think you asked earlier about the sort of importance of relevance and how that fits in with the real world learning. And I think that really also connects with what you're asking about here regarding students who are historically underserved and marginalized. I think, unfortunately, we see many Title I schools sort of doubling down on getting kids ready for the tests because that's what they're held accountable for. And so that takes some of the relevance and joy out of learning. And real world learning is all about relevance and relevance to the real world, relevance to students' interests. And so by infusing that, we are deepening engagement for students and creating more of an openness to learning. One example is, so we run these annual design day challenges with middle school students. This year we had students in New York who were redesigning subway stations, and they loved that challenge because every student has been in a subway station and they can count off all the different things that they hate about the subway station. And they really enjoy thinking about how to make it more tech friendly. And I think there was one group of students who added a basketball court onto the subway station, but it had some mechanism to make sure that the ball wouldn't fall onto the tracks. And then we had in Chicago, students were working with the architects of the Obama Presidential Center to design a outdoor plaza for the upcoming presidential center. So knowing that their ideas are grounded in the real world and that they might actually be picked up by people who are solving these challenges in real life is really invigorating and exciting for students and helps them see themselves in a different light.
How do you measure what makes one of these programs really successful? Because you mentioned test scores. If we're not just looking at those test scores, what else tells you that, hey, this is a good program?
Yeah,
we just had a big conversation about that today. We use a pre and post assessments of student interest, student confidence in their technology skills, student interest in careers. So a range of skills. We also place a lot of emphasis, connecting back to what I said about the maker pedagogy, on this set of, you know, what we call 21st century skills. So how can we measure levels of collaboration and empathy and persistence? So doing a pre and post test so we can actually come up with quantitative measures of that. And then we also have various observation protocols when we do visits to the schools. So we're using a range of methods and working with some really talented research organizations to constantly fine tune what we're doing.
Yeah, I get the picture that you should talk with other organizations that are asking the exact same thing. I feel like I had this discussion with the College Board people, the AP people, when they were trying to make the portfolio-based engineering test. But When you figure out the answers to these questions, please do share. I know you're focused on elementary and middle schools. I imagine that for older students, you would look at things like graduation rates. Are test scores worth anything? Like, is it useful at all to see test scores?
It's a tricky question. If I'm completely transparent, for funders' purposes, yes. But the kinds of interventions that we are supporting in schools are not specifically designed to improve test scores, though sure. We do believe very much so that the work that we are doing can influence students' learning and therefore influence their test scores. We are unable to show a direct causal relationship between the work that we're doing and the test scores that students are demonstrating. We have done some correlation to see, students who participate in programs run by teachers who are part of the SDC Maker Fellows program, how are they doing compared to other students? And we have seen some positive correlations there, but we have not dug much deeper into trying to tie our particular programs to outcomes. But as you mentioned at the high school level, of course, there are some different metrics that we're looking at. So we are looking at sort of at the high school level, we're kind of thinking of them as cross-career competencies, but really they're just sort of more sophisticated 21st century skills of the soft skills that we hear so much from employers about how they need soft skills in their new employees. But then we also are looking at like their professional skills and have you written a resume and a cover letter and can you interview effectively? And as Roger mentioned, sort of career interest and awareness. And then also we do look at graduation rates and what are their post-secondary plans. Mm-hmm. So, with the career pathways programs we were talking about earlier, where we are helping schools build out essentially programs aligned to CTE standards, career and technical education. We had the first school that we were working with, they graduated their first cohort in the spring. And there was one student in particular. I mean, there was a lot of wonderful post-secondary plans for the students who graduated, but there was one student in particular who we were able to help connect up with a local manufacturing company to secure a job. And so we were really excited about that because that is sort of the ultimate goal, is to help these young people successfully navigate their education portion of the pathway and find meaningful employment that is going to allow them to be happy, independent, successful adults.
It's funny, that actually was going right into the next thing I wanted to ask you. I was wondering, what is the difference between classical CTE, career and technical education, or not classical, but CTE today, and what you're advocating for? Like, my understanding of CTE is that you teach students skills that they really can apply right away mm-hmm. to careers.
Yeah, our career pathway programs are very much in line with CTE programs. So we work with a particular school to build out an industry-specific pathway that aligns with specific credentials and helps students develop in-demand skills so that they could both apply them while they're in high school and, potentially get internships. And then upon graduation, the hope is that they really will I like to say that we help kids lead choice-filled lives so that they can go to college, because there's a lot of research that shows that students who have participated in CTE programs have higher college completion rates because they, I think, can ground their education in sort of the why and persist through the challenges that students may face during college. They also could go straight into an apprenticeship program, or they could get hired straight out of high school. There's a lot of jobs that don't require college, so they could sort of develop a strong career pathway without college, or they could have their employer pay for their college so that they aren't indebted by the time they're 25. So we do have some programs that are much more aligned with CTE, but we do also believe that there's value in sort of broader exposure. So like we have this E2E Gap program that helps students, they conduct a career interest survey and then sort of go through a mock job application process where they write a resume and a cover letter and they get feedback on it and then they learn interview skills and they do mock interviews and then we place them with a local employer for a one-day job shadow based on their career interest survey. And I think, you know, whether they end up loving that externship and realizing this is exactly what I want to do when I graduate, or hating it and realizing, actually, I thought I wanted to do that, but I really don't. It's really valuable because it helps them think about what they want to do next. So they don't have to be locked into a particular pathway to have a powerful career readiness experience.
You mentioned lots of really great programs. To me, it sounds really great, but it also sounds at the same time resource heavy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a fair judgment. Like, it sounds like to set this up, you need the right staff on hand to do it. You need the time to do it. And that's a big problem, I guess, for teachers. And then money, of course. So how does a school, how does a teacher implement real world learning like these programs in their own situations?
Well, one broad thing I'll say before we share particular examples is, so this was something we were really intentional about when we created the real world learning rubric, is that this is a journey and that there's a lot of different factors that can contribute to how sort of extensively a school can implement real world learning. And there's no judgment about where you are. So, you know, when we were intentional about the categories, so emerging, you know, no school has, I don't know of any schools that are absolutely doing nothing. You know, whether you have one teacher who's sort of innovative and trying something new, or whether you have a grade level, you know, there's always pockets of excitement and real world learning that you can find in schools. And then as you move along the rubric, the next step is progressing, which I think probably the bulk of our schools fit into. And then at the highest level is leading, not exemplary, because you're never done with this journey. There's always more you can do. And we also think that schools who are leading in this have sort of an obligation or a responsibility to share what they're doing and help be leaders so that others can get ideas about what to do. Because I think one thing we've always believed at Schools That Can, I think this is true for students as much as it is for teachers, is you can't be what you can't see. So, you know, you can hear these great ideas, but it's hard to think about how to put them into practice if you haven't actually seen what that looks like. But if you don't have, I mean, ultimately, yes, there are some conditions that would enable this more successfully. Like if, right. I think there's work to advocate for this across New York City, but to get like work-based learning coordinators into every school so that there can be somebody who's connecting with local partners. I think there are a lot of apps that can help people sort of get started with this. So one thing that comes to mind is something called SOLE, S-O-L-E, which stands for Self-Organized Learning Environment. And I think it's startsoul.org. They have an app that can help teachers identify sort of big, hairy questions that are aligned to standards and guides them through a lesson plan that supports inquiry-based learning. So all you need is, you know, one 45-minute period, and you StartSoul can give you a place to start where you are sort of flipping the script on your lesson and having your students, whether they're elementary students or high school students, dig into these big questions and do research and present. There's also, I think it's called Nepris, is an app that helps connect teachers to industry experts across the globe. So you can sort of beam an expert into the classroom to talk to students and bring that relevance to a project that they're working on and help give them exposure to additional professions. I know there's also community in-person focused sort of version of this called Community Share that helps connect teachers to locally to industry experts in their community so that they can physically come in and work with the students. So if you don't have the infrastructure in place at your school to build out a full program, there are a lot of easy ways to get started as an individual teacher.
Okay. And just to be clear, it's not all going out to other institutions or companies. You talked about, I think, Roger, you mentioned managing the makerspace programs. It sounds like there's actual lessons or curricula that you think could be implemented within the school itself to bring some hands-on learning into play?
Sure. There's a lot of resources out there. We work in our programs directly with teachers because, you know, we're not going to, we don't want to be in the business of going into schools and doing the facilitation and things ourselves, because it's not sustainable, or it's not as sustainable as teachers building their practices. So we focus on the professional development of teachers so that, you know, the teachers are part of the school culture. They know their students, they're trusted by their students. So if they can even level up their skills and feel comfortable with the computer science or with the engineering approach, then they can implement that not just in an after-school club where they might start because it's a low-risk environment with more time, but they can build it into their instructional practice, whether it's in science or we've seen it in ELA, we've seen it in social studies. So, you know, just building up the practices of the teachers, we see the most bang for your buck. And that's where a lot of our focus is. And as Casey was saying, there's a lot of great resources. There's something called Engineering is Elementary, which is a site that provides a lot of great resources for at the elementary level to get students excited about engineering and using that kind of problem solving approach.
Is there any difference between students who self-select to participate in one of these programs versus, say, students who are forced to, for lack of a better word?
Well, I'd say that by default, if you're running an after-school club, you're going to have a self-selection issue usually, unless you just do a pure lottery of who's in there. So that's definitely something we've seen, and we'll do our assessments. And sometimes if you see little growth among some students, it may be because they already are really excited about this. And it doesn't mean that they don't get a lot out of the program, and they can be guides. And we emphasize students being guides for their fellow students, you know, so that's part of the collaboration and the empathy that's part of the maker approach. And that supports the teacher. Takes the load off the teacher so that they can focus on the students who really need their help. It builds up a sense of efficacy and autonomy among the students that are involved there, and the other students feel more connected, and it brings up the other students. So there's a lot of great benefits to just taking that kind of approach. But to answer your question, yeah, so there is a difference, and I think that's why we're excited when schools make the decision to support their teachers to bring this into the practice in the schools and create maker spaces within the school day, or create, one of our schools has created exploration labs, which is essentially like an interdisciplinary STEM learning space built into the school day. And when schools do that, then every student in a grade or in multiple grades are getting exposed and being a part of like exciting interdisciplinary STEM engineering problem solving.
Yeah. At the risk of going off topic too much, it makes me think of teacher preparation programs. Like if you're going to study to be a teacher in college, do you think those people studying to become teachers, that universities are preparing teachers to teach in this way? Or do you think that this is like a special extra training or professional development that they should go through as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll just say one thing on that is that the next generation science standards I mentioned, there are definitely a lot of resources, and we're involved with some projects continuing to build those resources. So I think the adoption by most, like I think 45 of the 50 states have pretty essentially adopted the next generation science standards. So the integration of next generation science standards specifically into, now that's tends to be specifically for science education teachers, but that the bringing that in, so that's definitely coming into the system. But the other thing that we're seeing is that funding organizations here in New York City are putting a lot of emphasis on making sure that pre-service teachers are engaging with ideas of computational thinking and that kind of approach to and a problem-solving approach, so that they're equipped to do this from the beginning.
Yeah, this is not an area of expertise for Schools That Can, so I'm sort of speaking anecdotally, but I think in general they're not doing it enough. But there definitely are pockets, and there's more programs who are trying to incorporate this. I know like I heard recently about Penn Graduate School of Education has a project-based learning certificate that they're offering now. I don't know how that factors into their pre-service program, and are all teachers, are all pre-service teachers benefiting from this or not? But I think that they all should be learning to do this in some way, for sure.
That's a fair judgment. I know that here in Texas, the UTeach program tries to push that as well. But it also makes me think, Casey, you had talked like at the very beginning about how Schools That Can really works cross-sectionally with different types of schools. And I'm also wondering, before we get to the end of our hour, have you noticed any differences between, say, public or district schools and the charter schools or private or independent schools in terms of how they can implement real-world learning programs? And I ask this because when I have spoken to a lot of teachers implementing other programs, they definitely have their opinions about, like, public schools have a lot more hoops to jump through and are maybe slower, whereas charter schools might not have the funding or something, even if they can move faster. Like, what are the differences in these types of schools and how they can implement these programs successfully?
Yeah, definitely. I think we've seen some shifts, and it also varies from city to city based on the sort of political climate and current leadership there. Overall, in general, yes, charter schools have a little bit more flexibility to jump in and do something, but they also may have a lot of different initiatives that are competing and so might not be able to sort of find the time to fit something like this in. And independent schools, because we work only with schools that serve predominantly low-income communities, the independent schools we work with, for the most part, have pretty tight budgets because they're fundraising pretty much their entire budget so that students, instead of relying heavily on tuition, so they have limited resources to do additional things like this and do need to rely on sort of outside funders or free programs and opportunities. I think considering the districts, they do have more hoops to jump through. The sort of flip side of that is that if there is a citywide imperative that aligns with this, then there is sort of more buy-in. So I think one example of this is in New York, we've been running our STEM Maker programs for about 5 years. Early on, we had mostly charter schools who were participating. And part of this is because we didn't have funding to pay teachers per session rates for the attending the trainings or for running programs after school. We then received a significant grant that allowed us to pay teachers for their time running the after school program. And then we pretty much shifted over to entirely district schools. And I think part of that is because there is a really big citywide push in New York City to make sure that all students K through 12 have CS learning experiences, the Computer Science for All initiative across New York. So they really saw this as a way of helping to address that imperative. And by identifying what was the barrier, which was this per session, which is required in the district contracts, then we were able to remove that barrier. And then we have a lot of interest from district schools. So I think it really varies on sort of the local funding climate, the local priorities. There are some districts we work with that seem to play musical chairs every summer. And so it's really hard to have continuity if leadership is changing. You know, I would be hesitant to make any sort of blanket statement about one sector being more open to innovation than another. I think truly, like, there's great things happening in every sector. There are bad things happening in every sector. And part of that cross-sector sort of component of who Schools That Can is that we really believe that it's more about what are you doing with students than what's your governance or funding structure.
And the one thing I'd add to that on that topic is it goes back to the roots of Schools That Can, is that, you know, as I'm sure you're very well aware, independent schools all often have like a very high level of resources and very well-equipped maker spaces. And those are the schools most likely to actually have engineering education. You know, as I'm sure you're really, really aware, traditional high school curriculums are focused on science and not on engineering. Right. So what we found here in New York City is that there is interest among the independent schools to share with other, with district, with public schools, whether it's district or charter, to share their ideas, to engage with them, to engage with their students. We've had a really close partnership with a school in the Upper East Side here in New York City to engage where they've been, they're really excited to create a STEAM consortium with the public schools in their neighborhood. And there's other independent schools we've also engaged with where they've invited public schools into their spaces to engage in these design thinking design days. So that's one of the places Schools Again started was, you know, a lot of public schools just like, oh, the, you know, the independent schools, those are the fancy private schools that have all the money and we don't want to talk to them. But, you know, if you go beyond the stereotypes, educators are educators, and their people are interested, often interested to share ideas and resources. And I think Schools Again has seen that over many years at our national forums and just in like local initiatives that pair independent schools with public schools.
All right. Well, thank you. That I feel like I've only touched the surface about the many things that y'all do over at Schools That Can. And I'm happy that you mentioned you're basically being supported by that CS for All initiative. I first learned about it a couple of years ago, and I've been anxious to see how's it been going in New York City. Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Is all this stuff going to be discussed at your national forum coming up in New York City?
Most of it, yeah. We have we had an open RFP process, and we got some really amazing submissions from schools and partners that we work with to highlight some of these practices that we discussed. And we'll also have some bigger picture panel discussions about, you know, what is the future of work in cities look like, and what does that mean for our students, and how can we make sure that we are emphasizing culturally relevant and sustaining computer science education. And it should be a really exciting event.
We'll kick it off with a pop-up makerspace on the first day at Cornell Tech, which will bring in students from around the city, which we're excited about too.
That's perfect. I hope there's videos and stuff for people who can't make it. How can people attend and learn more?
If you go to schoolsthatcan.org, in the top right corner, you'll see a button for our 2020 SDC Forum. And that page has, you can see our agenda. You can click directly to the registration page and contact information if you have any questions.
Very cool. Speaking of the future of all of this, where do you think the future of real world learning is going beyond, say, digital technology? I feel like everyone has heard about computational thinking. Is there any other directions that we should know about that you think is on the horizon?
One thing I'll say is it feels like the time for real world learning has come, even though we sometimes joke because this is not a new concept. This is what John Dewey was advocating for more than 100 years ago. But it seems to be really building momentum and interest in the education space more generally now. And I think that one thing we're seeing is, even though we are really focused on computer science and bringing in computational thinking, there's more and more questions, especially from educators, about like, what are the downsides of technology, and how can we help students engage with the real world without relying too heavily on technology? So, you know, thinking about unplugged activities that help develop problem-solving skills that could be applied to computers or not, and really just get into the real world. So I think we don't want to use technology as a crutch, but really as a tool to support interesting new innovations in real world learning that wouldn't be possible otherwise.
And I just wanted to ask one final question to both of you. I know you both have educational experience and backgrounds, and I want to hear from both of you, including Roger, because you started out in engineering as well. Why did you work into education?
Yeah, Pius, it's something that it's just always been something I've been really fascinated by. You know, I think I had an education experience that really challenged me and stimulated me and exposed me to a lot of different things. And then I spent 10 years out of the country working in developing countries, and I saw a lot of examples of students. And I at the same time was reading about so many students in our own country that just don't have those experiences. And I just went to public schools, but, you know, well-resourced public schools in a suburban area of Pennsylvania. And, you know, so many students that don't have those same opportunities and did not get a chance to get exposed to that. And coming from a family of educators, I felt like, you know, and feeling like that giving back matters. I feel like that's what brought me back to the U.S. and to education, because building for the future, I think, is something that everyone needs to think about. And that's education's the foundation for society.
Yeah, and somewhat similarly, I always knew that I wanted to work with youth in some way. You know, when I was growing up, I was a part of the Big Brother, Big Sister program. I was a camp counselor and a babysitter. So I was always sort of working with kids myself, even when I was a kid, and started studying child development and psychology in college, and then sort of realized that, the avenue where I wanted to be able to have that impact was through education. I think similar to Roger, I also I attended public schools, but really high quality public schools right outside of Boston, where I had really world-class learning experiences, including a lot of real-world learning experiences. And then when I was sort of faced with the stark differences between my experience and the experience of many students, in particular, I was worked for a policy think tank and was running the numbers on graduation and dropout rates for high school students in LAUSD, and just realized how different that was from what I had experienced. And I sort of have been committed ever since then to working to try to address that, that gap through education, which I think can be a great equalizer.
Casey, Roger, thank you so much for talking with me in this long hour. I am very inspired by what you all are doing, and that's really all I have to say. So thanks for what you do, and I think more people should check out Schools That Can and your programs.
Great. Thank you so much.
Great to speak with you. Well,
hope we can see you at the forum in May.
That was Casey Lamb, COO, and Roger Horton, Director of Maker Programs from Schools That Can. This podcast is sponsored by my studio, Pios Labs, in Austin, Texas, and also by The Engineer's Guide to Improv and Art Games. The show is also made possible by amazing individual donors who financially support the show on Patreon. It's really easy to donate. You could do it too at patreon.com/PiosLabs. Visit the podcast website for show notes, links, transcripts, and more. Go to k12engineering.net. That's K, the number 12, engineering.net. Thanks to all the educators and engineers working in this engineering education space, and thank you for listening. Stay safe out there.